before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free. No more moaning, no more moaning, no more moaning over me. And before I'd be slave, I'd be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. Before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free. Come and go with me to that land. Come go with me that land, oh, yeah, to that land where I'm bound. Come go with me to that land, go with me to that land, oh, yeah, to that land where I'm bound. There's no need in that land. There's no need in that land. No need in that land where I'm bound. There's no need in that land. No need in that land. No in that land where I'm bound. Won't you come and go with me to that land? Come go with me to that land. Go with me to that land where I'm bound. Come go with me to that land. I'm on my way, and I won't turn back. I'm on my way, and I won't turn back. I'm on my way. My brother.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes America's Path to Permanent War. Harry Chrysler talks with Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University, for a discussion of the causes and consequences of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. Basevich explores the origins of militarization and the factors that sustain their existence for more than six decades. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, former senior analyst at the CIA, discusses why the corrupted mainstream U.S. media needs to be supplanted by WikiLeaks to preserve our liberties. They comment on the State Department's successful interference with Spanish and German courts seeking to indict U.S. officials.
Mm-hmm. And I should remind our audience that you retired as a colonel in the military, and I want to use that as a platform to really look at your critique of Petraeus in the book, and his not necessarily of him personally, but of his doctrine, and what you are suggesting as a former military man is that the definition of what the military is to do in counterinsurgency at a certain level becomes surreal and absurd in the sense that our understanding of the military is as an organization which has a niche in society, which fights wars which are won or lost, but which then, you know, results in peace. But now with this new doctrine, that's no longer the goal of our military. What is the goal, and does it make any sense?
I don't think it makes any sense, and the goal is exceedingly vague. But let's backtrack a second.
Yeah.
I mean, war is an ugly business, war is a dirty business, war is a bad business. War makes no sense unless the use of violence can achieve your important political purposes quickly, efficiently, and economically. Now, the fact that war is such an elusive phenomenon means that it's very difficult to tame war. But nonetheless, if you can't tame it, it's not politically useful, and certainly it makes no sense whatsoever. Counterinsurgency, in a sense, acknowledges that war cannot be tamed. Counterinsurgency dismisses the notion of victory in battle as old-fashioned. Counterinsurgency says, well, what we're going to use our army for is to win hearts and minds, to create legitimacy in countries where legitimate institutions do not exist. And exponents of counterinsurgency say, we can't tell you how much this is going to cost or what the timeline is, because the entire enterprise is so uncertain that kind of predictability now has become completely impossible. So yes, I think in a very fundamental sense, it does become a deeply irrational exercise. Even more than that, let's take the case of Afghanistan. Afghanistan becomes irrational because even if Petraeus could wave his magic wand and transform Afghanistan into a liberal democracy tomorrow, the threat posed by violent anti-Western jihadism would not appreciably be reduced, because the jihadists are not headquartered in Afghanistan. Jihadism doesn't come from Afghanistan. Jihadism is a transnational movement. It is not located anywhere. So you have to ask yourself, if indeed the pacification of Afghanistan promises to be an uncertain and protracted and excessively costly enterprise, and if even the pacification of Afghanistan doesn't actually enhance your security, then what sense can this enterprise possibly make? And if it makes no sense, why doesn't the senselessness of the war, why isn't that a centerpiece of discussion of the war in Washington and outside of Washington?
And at this point, don't we, unfortunately, the default position is the Washington Credo, where you started, because in Cuba, we had to be there, not because Cuba was necessarily the most important pawn on the chessboard, but rather because if we didn't show our political will there, then we would send the wrong message.
Who knows what terrible things would happen some
and
other place.
Which fast forward to Bundy's memo on Vietnam, the same thing. And now, of course, we get the same argument on Afghanistan,
right.
Which is that if we don't fight, it's not so much that if we lose Afghanistan, it's a problem, but rather we will demonstrate that we don't have the political will or the means to act.
That Osama bin Laden and the Taliban will claim a victory and will therefore be strengthened.
And you actually quote Wolfowitz in your book on Iraq, where he actually says, well, we have to put up this fight because we will appear intimidated and they will, you know, attack us somewhere else.
So as a consequence of that thinking, we may not appear intimidated, we just appear stupid.
That's right.
We demonstrate our willingness to engage in self-destructive behavior. Because of our fear of looking weak. I mean, many other commentators have made this point. What satisfaction Osama bin Laden must draw from the fact that the United States has now been bogged down in Afghanistan for 9 years, that we have spent between Iraq and Afghanistan at least $1 trillion, some people say $2 trillion, that we have lost all of these soldiers, dead and wounded, and that in the meantime, bin Laden himself continues to be hidden away in some cave probably in Pakistan. What is the return that we are getting on our investment? It seems to me that it's pretty limited. And I think that nobody can be happier with the course of U.S. policy since 9/11 than Osama bin Laden. Because we are playing into his hands. We are weakening ourselves.
You are very concerned about the consequences of all of this for American democracy, and I want to get back to this quality of the debate and the extent to which there is no debate. And I want to raise one issue, because in the 1990s, one of the ideas that emerged as a legitimation of the notion of interventionism was the notion of humanitarian interventionism. And this really was coming from the left,
right,
of center,
kind
of
hawkish in left.
The hawkish left of the establishment. And that's a kind of an interesting problem, because one thing that's at work here is our self-conception, you know, and this notion of, well, let's be the example to the world, let's show the world how to do it just by what we do here at home, gets subverted very easily by people who are willing to say, look, we've got to go there, you know, and help the people. And in fact, there is a controversy this week with regard to this Time cover of the picture of the horrible things done to this Afghan woman, and this is why we should be there. So how, as part of the debate, which I think you're trying to make an effort to revive, do we sort of get a hold of the idea that we can be an example, but we, you know, we can and probably don't want to be everywhere?
Well, I think that I don't think that great powers take seriously moral considerations in the construction of policy. And that statement applies to the United States as much as to any other power in the world. We like to think that we are different. I don't really believe that when it's six people sitting around a table in the Oval Office trying to decide what to do about Saddam Hussein, they don't begin by saying, what's the right thing to do? That said, there are Americans, many Americans, and I think well-intentioned Americans, who believe that moral considerations, at least in our discussion of foreign policy, should be included. And I agree with that. But I would insist that it has to be a moral debate that is a serious debate, that is not simply kind of slapping a bumper sticker on things. So with regard to Afghanistan, I think I would pose the following questions. Question number one, if we should set out to acquit our moral obligation to other peoples, why do the people of Afghanistan come first? How about the people of Iraq, that war that we are already forgetting? How about the people of Mexico, our nearest neighbor, where U.S.-Mexican relations over a couple hundred years have not exactly contributed to the well-being of the Mexican people? And today, the American demand for drugs and lax American gun laws are directly contributing to a wave of violence in Mexico that is undermining already weak institutions. Don't we have a moral obligation to the people of Mexico? Why should Afghanistan come first? That's question number one. Question number two, I think, is if indeed the moral obligation to the people of Afghanistan comes first, why is the best way to acquit that moral obligation to continue a war that's already 9 years long and that has not done much for the Afghan people? I mean, if indeed concerns for that woman who had been mutilated apparently by her brutal husband, if we're concerned about that woman, why not let all the women who have concerns about their well-being come here and live here and be safe here? Give them sanctuary. Of course, you know and I know that the prospect of 500,000 Afghan female refugees would set off a wave of protest from Americans saying, we don't want them in our country, which in a sense exposes the shallowness of some of this moral concern. And then the third thing I would say is, if indeed the perpetuation of war is the right way to meet our obligation to the Afghans, then should we not at least as a people be willing to pay for the war rather than sort of laying the responsibility for the conduct of the war on 0.5% of the population while the rest of us watch? I mean, do I send some 19 or 20-year-old kid for his third combat tour to Afghanistan so I can feel better about what we're doing for Afghan women? If it's important to send that 19-year-old kid, am I willing to pay for it? It costs $1 million per year per soldier to wage this war. How much money, how much additional tax dollars am I willing to pay in order to keep those soldiers there protecting Afghan women? Of course, the answer for most of us is, I'm not willing to pay any additional tax dollars. I'm not willing even to pay for the war that's going on, because the war that's going on is being paid by borrowed money. So I believe we need to have moral considerations play a large role in public debate over foreign policy, but it needs to be a serious discussion.
This conclusion leads me to say that one doesn't see a handle to get on top of these issues. You point out that in this history there are people, we've already talked about Eisenhower, but there's Senator Fulbright after the Vietnam War. There's the head of the Marine Corps, General Shoup, who essentially pointed out some of the things that you're pointing out, and they don't lead anywhere. And so the question becomes, how do we act on the basis of your analysis? What are we lacking? Are we lacking a political movement? Are we lacking factions within the military and the foreign policy establishment that can make these arguments and make things happen? As we've already discussed, many people voted for Obama on the hope of a change of direction. Do you see an answer, something that will ignite action based on the kind of analysis you're making?
Well, it's a great question. And I mean, as you tick off names like Fulbright and General Shoup and Dr. Martin Luther King, people who did articulate dissent from positions of authority, moral authority, and yet that dissent never caught hold. It tended to be a passing complaint that was then swept aside. So how can you operationalize dissent so that it can translate into effective political action? You mentioned in asking that question, maybe the military changes its mind. And I think that is something that merits watching. I'm getting an increasing number of emails. I don't mean thousands. But an increasing number of emails from young officers that I've never met who have read something that I've written and who say, I think you're right, I agree with you, or at least I've got some more questions that indicate that they're kind of responding to the kind of critique that I advance. I do believe that if the officer corps begins to doubt the Washington rules, that may provide an opening for serious debate. But more broadly, I think, you're never going to have dissent that translates into effective political action as long as the perpetuation of the Washington rules doesn't affect the great majority of us directly. And again, you go back to this point that a very small percentage of the population serves and sacrifices, the rest of us watch. And indeed, we refuse even to meet our obligation to pay for the wars that occur on our watch and are supposedly so important. If we had to pay, if they raised our taxes to cover the costs, ongoing costs of the war, then I think all of us as citizens would be far more receptive to what the dissenters had to say.
Yeah, so and this will be the final question. So in a way, is it fair to say that a key element would be the changing balance of power in the world, that increased multipolarity will create a situation where as we decline and others rise, we're not going to be able to pay for this.
We should recognize that right now.
Yeah.
I mean, and again, I may shy away from terms like decline because that suggests gloom and doom. I don't think it has to be gloom and doom. I think we need to recognize the reality of the world in which we live. The world in which we live is not the world of 1947. We don't have all the money anymore. And we need to adjust our commitments and obligations to correspond to the resources we have. And that does require making more modest claims than the claim made in the American Credo, and having a more prudent and realistic military policy than the one that we've pursued under the terms of the Sacred Trinity.
Well, on that note, Andrew, I want to show your book again and recommend that everyone go out and buy it because it's really a compelling account of where we are in our foreign policy and its militarization, but also the implications that has for our domestic polity. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
First we got the bomb, and that was good, 'cause we love peace and motherhood. Then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay, 'cause the balance of power is maintained that way. Who's next? France got the bomb, but don't you grieve, 'cause they're on our side, I believe. China got the bomb, but have no fears, they can't wipe us out for at least 5 years. Who's next? Then Indonesia claimed that they were gonna get one any day. South Africa wants two, that's right, one for the black and one for the white. Who's next?
Egypt's gonna get one too, just to use on you-know-who. So Israel's getting tense, wants one in self-defense. The Lord's our shepherd, says the psalm, but just in case, we better get a bomb. Who's the next? A Luxembourg is next to go, and who knows, maybe Monaco. We'll try to stay serene and calm when Alabama gets the bomb. Who's next? Who's next? Who's next? Who's next?
And now for something completely different.